Concert pianist Ralph Vodopek once again returns to the Fontana Summer Festival tonight for a concert of works for two pianos with his wife Albertine Vodopek. The program will feature great classics such as the Fantasia by Franz Schubert and Brahms' Variations on a Theme of Haydn, plus rarely heard arrangements of works of Debussy and Piazzolla. I spoke to Mr. Vodopek about his 50-year career as a concert pianist, his biennial trips to Argentina, and his long association with the Fontana Summer Festival, which goes back to his friendship with founder Neil Saunders.
The first time I played at Fontana, I believe, was in 1981, which is only the second year of its founding, and I immediately became attracted to that venerable old general store there in Shelbyville. And I guess they lasted at least 20 years there. And I used to play every other year, always a solo recital, and then also a chamber music program with Neil and some of his fellow musicians from England and Western Michigan University. And enjoyed the Plainwell ice cream during intermission. And I was always kind of surprised that they would review the concerts, not only in Kalamazoo, but in Grand Rapids. And, you know, extensive reviews, and so they took the series very seriously. And I guess eventually, the upper floor started to tilt a little bit, and they had to leave the general store at Shelbyville, and they went to Kalamazoo.
Neil Saunders had a great experience professionally and collegially in London with his colleagues in the Melos Ensemble, and wanted to recreate something like that here in his new university position during summertime.
It was a good thing. I mean, very often in summer, things slow down, and I would always go to Argentina every other year. But those years that I didn't go, I would go to Argentina in the even years, and in the odd years, he always invited me to play at Shelbyville, and I was grateful for that. And, I remember playing a lot of unusual things like the Foray, G minor piano quartet, and things by Janacek and Vincent Dandy. And he was always a pleasure to work with. And then his wife, who was the artist. And I believe I visited them once at Podunk Lake, where they had their home. And he was unique. He was a unique character and a fine horn player. If you get players that are more or less of even stature or caliber, ability, whatever, there's never a problem. It's always a give-and-take situation. And especially, I've heard, of course, string quartets, when they have to practically live together for years, there the tensions arise more. But when you're playing chamber music, you get there the day or two before and you rehearse a couple of times, there's no time for arguments, for tension, and it's usually a pleasure. I mean that. I've never been part of a standard chamber group, but I know my children have, and other people have, and it's not always a song and dance, you know. But when you get together a day or two before a concert, and you know your part, and they know their part, it's a wonderful experience, I think. There's something fresh about it.
Right. I know how wonderful and awful a deadline it can be. I mean, you can make decisions awfully quickly when there's a deadline.
Right, right. I think with the chamber music, it would be 2 days before we would get together, and one day, and then maybe the day off. So maybe there were two or three rehearsals, but they always seem to fill that little 130, 140 foot space there. And I always enjoyed driving over there, you know, through Hastings and Gun Lake. And it was something to always look forward to. And then once, I believe it was in 91, my wife and I did a four-hand recital there. See, they had one good Steinway concert grand, but of course only one. And so we did a four-hand program.
And you and Albertine will be the featured artists for Fontana's Summer Festival concert on Tuesday, 7:30 at the Wellspring Theater. Ralph, you Your career, however, has been preparing solo works for the concert hall, along with your long-standing professorship at Michigan State University. Am I right in that you have a particular affinity for music of maybe the early 20th century, the French composers, and some of the Argentine composers as well?
That could be. I've always liked 20th century music, and of course, pre-1950, there's so much to offer from the French, the Russians, the Spanish, the Americans, the Germans. After 1950, there is less, although I've recorded some Nikolai Kapustin, contemporary Russian jazz composer. But my most of my CDs deal with early 20th century music. Goyesque is of Granados, and the 24 Debussy Preludes, and works by Szymanowski and Finisterre, Poulenc.
It's a beautiful musical language of that time that could borrow from Baroque technique all the way to, you know, 20th century dissonance.
Well, especially the first 10, 15 years of the century, there was just so much going on in all these countries, and they were all so different. And not to forget the Americans, too. I love playing Copland, although I've never recorded Copland, but a little bit of Ives, violin sonatas, and Gershwin. You know, people always like Gershwin. That never goes away. I've made several CDs, usually make 1,000 copies, and the Gershwins, I'm down to only 30 left, and I usually don't even put them out. But some of the others, they're lingering in my basement in various music stores. Still have several hundred of Schubert sonatas and Debussy preludes. It's not a good business, of course, but I came late to making CDs. But people said, well, why don't you make some CDs? And it happened that Earl Wilde, a late pianist who recorded so much and had this huge repertoire, he had this company called Ivory Classics, and his aim in the 1990s was to record people who had not had been recorded much, and also to promote some of his records, things that he had recorded but had never been released. And so, just out of a whim, I had come back from Argentina, and I had recorded Szymanowski, Poulenc, Finisterre, and Piazzolla. And I sent the tape to him, and he took it and released it, and it was a slight moneymaker, and which hardly ever happens. And then I did two other recordings for him in subsequent years. So I was always grateful to Earl Wilde. I mean, I thought it was a rather unselfish venture of him to do this.
And so folks could find those discs today on Ivory Classics.
Yeah, there's, you know, Amazon and some stores locally. And it's like a calling card. I mean, you have to have CDs. And I think I'm too old to make videos. but people now, you know, in promotion, they always want videos now, not just compact discs.
Oh, my. I know I'm reaching you today at your office or your studio. Is that at Michigan State?
Yes, it is. We had a deal. I offered to retire when I was 65, 10 years ago, you know, sometimes people hang on a long time when they have some moderate success in teaching. But I thought, oh, there are hundreds of people that would like my job. And so I offered to retire on the conditions that I could keep a small studio in the music practice building. And so I wear out their piano most days when I'm in town. And it's been a good arrangement because I still collaborate with quite a few colleagues on the faculty. And I play a solo recital every year, and occasionally with the orchestra. So in a sense, I always say I'm only 25% retired. I don't teach. If somebody knocks on my door, though, I'm glad to hear them. Yes, it's a very symbiotic relationship. I mean, I taught 36 years at State, and somehow that was, I felt like I had multiplied enough pianists. And so I wanted to retire just right at 65. It just seemed to be the right time to do it.
So does this allow you to go back to simply playing and exploring the literature and refreshing pieces? Do you have do you now schedule more concerts?
I have a manager in Chicago who does a little bit, and I frequently play recitals in Florida and around Michigan in Grand Rapids. I always play at the Art Museum, it seems, and various places, suburbs of Detroit. But I would say the bulk of my career has to do with Argentina and Michigan State. I'm going in 2 years. I was there last year, and I'm going in 2016, which will be the 50th anniversary of my first tour there, and that'll be the 26th tour. And, of course, Buenos Aires is a wonderful place to play, the Teatro Colón. It's very impressive. And then all the provinces, some of the bigger cities have very good venues, and I even like to play in some of the smaller places where the pianos are doubtful, but the audiences are warm, and the theaters are better than the pianos. I always say I almost rather play in a theater that has wonderful live, not overly live, but wonderful acoustics on a piano that's substandard than to play on a piano that's 10 points, but in a place that's dry. And sometimes one encounters that in the United States. I seldom encounter a bad piano in the United States, but I do in the provinces of Argentina, but it makes me appreciate the good pianos. I consider, as a pianist, I'm very lucky that I don't have to drag my instrument along. My son is a cellist, and of course, there you have to play a separate airline ticket. By the way, he's played a couple of times for Fontana around, I think it was around 2000. He played some chamber music. And also my daughter has played for Fontana, Catherine. She's a violinist, and when she was a member of the Chester Quartet, they played a concert with me at Fontana. She teaches violin and chamber music at the University of Michigan. And so she's in it. Let me see. My son, the oldest, Paul, he's a clarinetist. He's been principal of Naples Philharmonic for many, many years. Let's see, did he play at Fontana? I'm not sure. But it's like the whole family has been all part of it over the years.
As long as there's a Fontana, there'll be a Vodopek to play for it, it sounds like.
It could be, sure. Yeah. We don't invite ourselves, though. That's why this concert was quite a surprise, because it had been 9 years since I played for Fontana. Of course, I was a good friend of Neil Sanders. And, oh, what is the charming French lady's name that was there?
Anne Berquist.
Yeah, Anne Berquist, of course. And then after that, I didn't know the new director. He didn't know me. And so I didn't think I'd ever play in Fontana again. And lo and behold, I think it was in March, Dave Baldwin called. You know, in our business, we don't say no. I feel like I have a sort of affinity with Kalamazoo, because every year I'd ride the Cal Haven Trail from Kalamazoo to South Haven. And sometimes I do with some friends, and my wife drives a car, and we meet every once in a while to see if I'm still alive. And 35 miles, that's sort of my limit. I did it about 3 weeks ago, and about 10 miles of it was with a driving rainstorm. I arrived in, Bloomingdale, just soaking wet, but I wanted to go on. I just do it, you know. And then we always stay at a bed and breakfast place in South Haven, and then attach the bike to the car, and we ride back. Not on the bike. I don't go uphill. I only go downhill or on a level. And so we start around 800 feet above sea level and arrive at South Haven at 530 feet. So, but like I say, that's... I'm tired after that, but I think I've done this every year for the last 10 years. I just love that trail. I feel like I know every bend in the road, every little town. And, I guess the trail is now starts from downtown Kalamazoo. I should explore that, so I think I could probably do 40 miles.
Well, if we could get back to the music a little bit.
Okay.
Some of the greatest recordings we have in our library are of people like... Claudio Arrau in his 80s and Mieczysław Warszawski in his 90s. And so aging and piano playing aren't necessarily conflicting problems. How has this worked in your case?
Well, I've been very lucky. I don't suffer from arthritis or any health problems. It seems though, I don't know if you're going to see too many 80 or 90-year-old pianists performing anymore. It seems maybe we're all trying to play too loud or something. I mean, it kind of started with Leon Fleischer and Gary Graffman in the 60s, this muscle fatigue and focal dystonia or whatever you want to call it. And so we have to be careful. I mean, I remember once, believe it or not, just playing a Brahms piano quartet, and it had just an incredible number of legato octaves, and I started to feel a strain in my fifth finger, and I said to myself, I better stop, play some Mozart, or not do anything. And so it's possible. It's very possible for pianists to strain themselves, and they do it, even the young pianists sometimes. They get tendonitis and bursitis and things like that, but I always say the older pianists like myself, we tend not to, because we don't we're maybe not straining so hard. We don't play that many Prokofiev, Rachmaninoff concertos with orchestras. You know, that can kill you a little bit. That's what Gary Graffman said, that it was just too many Rachmaninoff Prokofiev concertos. Did Prokofiev with the Jackson Symphony a few weeks ago, the third, and but that was. I hadn't done any Prokofiev that season, and so that's an old friend. That's one of the two concertos I played in the finals of the Cliburn 52 years ago. So anyway, but one has to be careful. Yeah, it's,
sure.
We're not a machine.
How about in terms of artistic expression and experience, how that...
Oh, well, I don't know. I think maturity is overrated. No, that's, one would like to think that one is bringing more to music in your 70s than you did in your 50s or certainly in your 20s. But I'm not so sure that age is revered that much. I always was a big admirer of Claudio Rao because he came to Milwaukee when I was 16 and played a recital, and my teacher, who was a little bit brazen, brought me backstage and said, "What do you advise this young, talented boy?" You know, what was for Claudio to say. He said, "Well, practice very hard, because after you're 25, you're never going to get any better." So I figured I had 9 years to go to get better. And that was his advice. And in terms of maturity, well, depends. It's a little bit of a catch-22. If you try to always improve a limited amount of repertoire, maybe that'll happen, but you'll probably burn out. I mean, Cliburn is a classic example of that. I don't know. I'd prefer to be like Rubinstein, just play things, new things all the time. I'm learning right now Beethoven 109 sonata for the first time, and also two Max Reger clarinet sonatas that I have to play and record with our new clarinetist at State here, along with the two very famous Brahms clarinet sonatas. So, my mother always said, "You've got to learn new pieces all the time to stay young." And I kind of believe that, but it gets harder to learn new pieces. It takes me so long now to learn and memorize a piece. And I guess I do it. I learn a lot of things of collaborative nature, but very few new works of a solo nature. It took a lot out of me to learn about 3 or 4 Kapustin pieces to memorize them and play them. But I don't know about maturity. If it happens, I think if you're in good health and you're still enthusiastic about playing, it'll just happen on its own, maybe. But it's not guaranteed. I mean, to get older doesn't mean you're going to be more mature. I'm sorry. I wish I could say, yeah, it's guaranteed. As long as you keep playing, you're just going to get better and better. But, you know, I mean, some pianists peak when they're in their 40s, some when they're in their 60s. I think Rubinstein peaked when he was in his 70s. I don't think he got better. He got slower. Sometimes people get slower when they get older. I remember Arthur Fiedler. I used to play with him a lot. He was so good to me. He actually, as he got older, he always conducted faster because he wanted to resist that stigma of being old and being slow. And so we did a lot of Gershwin with him, and this was so fast. It was incredible. It was good.
Well, I think that's my favorite part of this interview, with you saying maturity is overrated.
Well, that's, it's like I say, if you're healthy and you're enthusiastic about music, it's there. It'll come maybe, but maybe at the expense of something else, maybe at the expense of technical facilities. I've been a judge at competitions recently, one in Washington, D.C. last month, and oh my goodness, they play so fast. And they're good. They're really good. But sometimes it's so fast I can't hear it that fast. I can't, it's too fast to hear. Yeah. Or sometimes I suspect they're fudging a little bit. But I sometimes admire their speed. But anyway, I always remember a review I got when I was like in my 30s in Argentina. It was called Los Peligros de la Virtuosismo, The Dangers of Virtuosity, in other words, you know. If you're a virtuoso and you can go against the music.
Well, let's finish up here by looking at the music for your Tuesday program at the Wellspring Theater, all of which includes your wife, Albertine Vodopek, in works for two pianos, four hands. We have Schubert Fantasy, Brahms Variations, Opus 56, the Debussy Sacred and Profane Dances, and some tangos by Piazzolla.
Right. The first half is just incredibly standard, maybe almost too much, although there aren't, one doesn't hear two piano or four hand recitals too often, but I think the Schubert Fantasy is the greatest work ever written for one piano, four hand. It's one of 30 works that Schubert wrote, but it's considered his masterpiece. And the Brahms, actually he wrote the variations on the theme of Haydn, he wrote that for two pianos first, although it's called 56B, but the orchestral version is probably more often performed. And the second half of the program is not standard, because one doesn't hardly ever hear the Debussy Sacred Profane Dances for two pianos, but Debussy wrote it for that, although it was commissioned and he wrote it for harp and string orchestra. But it's right there in the score. The piano one plays the harp part, piano two plays the orchestra part, and we switch off, Tina and I switch off about 10 times during the piece. It makes it more interesting so that one person is not just always playing the more important harp part. And the five Piazzolla tangos were arranged by Pablo Ziegler, who was Piazzolla's pianist in his quintet in his later years, and I think they're ingenious. They're wonderful arrangements. I mean, Piazzolla, in a way, is like Bach. You play it on the saxophone. You play it for various... he wrote his tangos mostly... his most successful vehicle was his quintet, which consisted of him on bandoneon and guitar, piano, violin, and bass. But they've been orchestrated, and I think we've played them quite a few times and have recorded them, and people always like them. I mean, you know, world music, I almost resent the fact that so many classical concerts have sort of fallen into so-called world music, you know, what, African drumming, Japanese this, gamelan, whatever. But Piazzolla, that's world music, too. I mean, that's considered world music. So we're just following a trend here.
Have you ever met Piazzolla in person?
Oh, I should have. He was playing in a nightclub two blocks from where I was staying several times, but his shows were at 12 midnight and 2 a.m., and I was just so serious, and I had concerts usually the next day, so I never went. My daughter, Catherine, when she was a student in New York, she happened into Central Park, and there was Piazzolla playing his famous Central Park concert in New York City. But I feel like I know the man. I mean, it's just I heard his music for the first time in 1972 in a province of Argentina, and I was just so taken with it. And it's Argentina. I mean, at first, of course, he was controversial because he did things with the tango that traditionalists didn't think should be done. But gradually, he was accepted. And there's a Plaza Piazzolla. He was on a postage stamp. I mean, he and Ginastera are the two great composers. It's world music, but I think very classy world music.
Well, I think I can speak for myself and a lot of other Fontana fans when I say I'm really looking forward to having you back at the Fontana Summer Festival. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity.